two-hour show every second Saturday through BBS Radio. It is November 27th, 2010. I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, where I live, and I have my small institute, which is simply run out of my home, and it's called Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. And this institute is kind of has a long history, actually. It goes back almost 25 years or longer, and through my life, I've become convinced of the importance of studying mystical and occult teachings from a scientific perspective, that we have to try to understand what's being taught in these systems of knowledge from a scientific viewpoint. So the idea of Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science is to take a scientific look at mystical and spiritual teachings. And at the same time, to have such a mystical spiritual perspective when we look at the results of modern science itself, because there are certain fundamental unsolved enigmas in modern science, and what the mystics have said are directly relevant to solving these mysteries. Particularly, we focus on the mysteries of human consciousness, and I try to explain and elaborate what I call the heart doctrine, which is the mystical view that a human being's inner self-awareness or awareness of being emerges within without through the heart, and that consciousness in the human being, it's not produced by the brain, in the mind, in the head, but rather it has to do with the heart and the influences of consciousness and the vitality of the spirit soul is distributed through the body, through the blood, as well as through the subtle anatomy. So in my view, consciousness isn't simply confined up in the head, but consciousness can be experienced throughout ourselves, and it's related to blood flow. And in this view, modern psychologists and scientists have made fundamental mistakes, thinking that the brain produces consciousness, even when no one can explain how or where that is done, and really it's a complete enigma. And we also have other basic misunderstandings, particularly as to the nature of self. See, in modern science, we do not consider that a human being really has any kind of individual I or element within them. Okay, we think a human being is, as Francis Crick says, a bunch of neurons, or a pack of neurons, I think he says, that we're made up of all these different neurons and cells, and we have the illusion of there being an I or central self, but really that's only an illusion. All it is the neurological processes of the mind, and that when a human being dies, then the I experience is no more. So death, in that view, is the end of life. The human being has no spiritual or soul nature. Whereas in mystical spiritual teachings, they explain that we live in a multidimensional body, and that we don't simply have a physical body, but we have subtle bodies, or what Gurdjieff would call higher being bodies. And one of the areas then we look at is this psychology of consciousness. And over the last two shows, we've been looking at the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching. And I want to pick up on that today. I'll give us a brief summary before we go on about what we covered last week. And we're kind of working our way through the book I've produced called Psychological Illusions, Explorations of the Gurdjieff Fourth Way Teaching. And My co-host is with me here is James Moffat. I always introduce you as James Moffat, and then I call you Jim. How are you?
Well, I'm a man of many identities. I have many eyes. Yeah, no, that's fine. I get that a lot. Yeah, how are you?
Okay, yes. Oh, I hung my sign up today on the front of my house here. My little had a 22-inch circular sign made up, which is really quite attractive, and hung it up on the front entrance to my house.
It looks good. You don't see that every day. It's nice.
Say again?
You don't see that every day. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, it's a striking sign a little bit. It's got that a ray of light coming down, and it divides through a prism, and it gives you a spectrum of colors. That's a nice graphic in it. There's so much embodied in that basic symbol, A, of the kind of white light divided by a prism and giving you a spectrum.
Yeah.
It's such a profound concept in esotericism.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you know, if you the more you know in terms of what it refers to in terms of mystical and esoteric teachings, the deeper your understanding of, like, something that looks simple is actually quite profound, and it's all of its applications and its meanings. It's like Gurdjieff said about his the sacred symbol in the fourth way that Gurdjieff introduces his Enneagram, and he said that if you really understood the Enneagram, you could understand basically anything by observing the Enneagram and referring to it, which seems outlandish on a certain level, but the more you understand the nature of how it embodies and symbolizes so much of the essential ideas in the Gurdjieff teaching, the more you realize why he says that, and that it's not quite as outrageous as it would seem to somebody who doesn't understand it. And I think that's true of all mystical and esoteric symbols and verbal formulas. Like, we've talked about that before. It's like something as simple as above, so below, or man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, or God is first one, then three, then seven. Those are all verbal formulas that for somebody who doesn't have a background or an understanding of mystical and esoteric teachings, you could take that on a very superficial level and say, well, that, you know, what, so what, you know, that doesn't really mean anything too terribly much. Does it mean anything at all? And yet somebody who knows what the basic principles would have a deeper understanding, and yet somebody who has studied for many years, as we have, would have an even deeper appreciation. I think that's one of the major things that we've learned over the many years of studying various esoteric and mystical teachings, is that how much more profound and deeper your understanding of things becomes as you gain more and more experience and establish more and more connections intellectually between different ideas in esotericism.
Yeah, Gurdjieff himself says, myths and symbols. Well, he says symbols such as, like, the Star of David or the Ladder of Jacob and the Tree of Life in Kabbalah, like these, he describes as, like, the language of the higher intellectual center. And then he describes myth as the language of the higher emotional center. And it's interesting because his book, Beelzebub's Tales, is like this mythical book. And I can see how that can impact people, like higher emotional center. But yeah, so symbols and myths are like the language of these higher centers. And in a way, he says, yeah, we have to attain to a certain level of development or higher state to be able to appreciate the depth of these symbols and how much knowledge can be embodied in them. Like where Gurdjieff says, if a man were alone in the desert, and he traced the Enneagram in the sand, and he could in it read the eternal laws of the universe. You know, so that, again, the Enneagram is a symbol of higher mystical knowledge, but we have to know how to understand what's embodied in it and its inner meaning. So today, we'll go through the fundamental cosmic laws, according to Gurdjieff, we're almost up to that point in our review, Jim, of the definitions of psychology, which we began last week.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe, one thing I want to do, I thought today we haven't taken phone-ins for, we seldom do, but I thought today, why don't we give out the number early? And if people want to call in through the day in regards to what we're speaking about, or if they've had questions or comments about previous shows or other materials, we can divert a little bit other issues. So, not sure if that was someone coming in. I heard some. Did you hear some?
It was a click. I don't.
In the back.
I'm not sure what that was, but yeah.
Okay. So, well, the phone in number is 888-815-9756, and we'll just keep it open today, and we'll kind of move through this material. And so, what we were elaborating was a series of definitions of psychology that acted from the Uspenskian explanation of the fourth way teaching. And as you read Uspensky's writing, he says, well, psychology must begin with this or that element. Okay, so I'm getting it repeated beeps a little bit here, Jim. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of a odd breakup at
Okay, so anyway, so the first definition that we went through is Uspensky says there's kind of psychology, which is the study of man as he is, or as we imagine him to be, and then there's a psychology which is that of man's possible evolution. Okay, so this is the first definition of psychology, is that it looks as a human being in terms of our possible evolution. And Gurdjieff explains this, one way he explains it is that there's all these possible seven levels of human development or evolution. So psychology is supposed to help us evolve through developing higher faculties and experiencing higher states of consciousness. So we want to evolve in terms of the development of our being. For Gurdjieff, most people are man number 1, 2, or 3, controlled by the physical, emotional, or intellectual nature. But in the fourth way, we want to bring those three aspects of ourselves into alignment and develop each of them such that we transfer and become a man number 4. Who's beginning to awaken to the state of self-consciousness and is beginning to have glimpses of real I, what Gurdjieff would call real I. And then man number 5 is an individual in whom the real I is constant. It's been attained. So, and then he has higher, that the man number 5 has attained the state of self-consciousness. And then the man number 6 and 7 is someone who develops the higher intellectual center and experiences states of objective consciousness, in which is revealed understanding and knowledge about the universe or cosmos or the world. So for Gurdjieff, then, first definition of psychology is that we want to study man in terms of his evolution, what faculties he can acquire and develop or attain within his being. And so there's one way of looking at that is in terms of the seven levels of human evolution or development. Another way of looking at that is, for Gurdjieff, the development of the higher being body, the astral body and the mental or spiritual body. So we want to evolve in terms of crystallizing or developing these bodies as possible vehicles for awareness. Okay, so that was the first definition which we have spoken of previously. And then we went on, we talked about the study of language and how in the Gurdjieff system they have a more precise language. And Gurdjieff explains, normally people don't really understand each other at all because everyone has a different language. and we have to have more precise definition of our terms. And he says we have to study language, including the principle of relativity, into our study of language. For example, we could say the word man, but what do we mean by the word man? Do we mean a man number one, a mechanical man number one, who's simply controlled by the pleasures and pains of the physical body? Or is a man number seven, like a Christ individual? Okay, so when we use a word like man, what we mean by that depends on the level of a human being. Or if we talk about words like I, what do we mean by I? And Gurdjieff says most people don't know real I, like capital I, singular I. All they know are little I's, because their moods and states are always changing and they're always caught up in what's happening in the moment. So they only know all little I's. So a word like what does I mean, it depends. To one person, it's a transitory mood or aspect of themselves, whereas another person might have attained his true I, which for Gurdjieff is the aim in the work. The third definition was psychology must involve the study of oneself, and how this is so ignored in modern psychology, that of course we can only study consciousness in ourselves. We can only know consciousness in ourselves. You can never see it in someone else or see it externally. So we have to study ourselves and what goes on in our inner life, in our inner world. That's how one studies oneself in the Gurdjieff system. You begin to make observations within your inner world of what goes on within you, and how the mind functions, and the emotions, and the sexuality, the different centers, and what he calls the wrong work of centers. So we begin this whole study of ourselves in the Gurdjieff teaching. And then the fourth definition, and this is that psychology involves the study of the centers. And Gurdjieff says that people ordinarily make a fundamental mistake when we think we have one mind. And we think we have a mind in the head and the body. So we have a dual kind of mind-body system. But Gurdjieff explains that really we are three and seven-brained beings. So he says we have a threefold nature in terms of functioning mentally, emotionally, and physically. So that's the threefold aspect, that so we are capable of thinking, feeling, and sensation and action, which go together, sensory motor functions. So we're kind of like this three-brained being. And in a way, each of these centers has its own mind. The intellectual center is centered in the head, but the emotional center involves the heart and the autonomic nervous system. And the moving instinctual center is the spinal brain. So Gurdjieff says we don't just have one mind, we really have these semi-independent minds within us. And each of these minds has a different language and a different speed of functioning, and it plays a different role in our psychological makeup and so on. So we begin to study ourselves then from this perspective in self-study. We try to be aware of what thinking is and how that relates to emotions and to sexuality. We try to make observations of ourselves, learning to differentiate the activities of the centers. And so Gurdjieff explains then that there are really five lower centers, which include three in the physical body, which are the moving, instinctual, and sexual centers. And then we have two emotional centers. One is simply called the emotional center, and then the second called the higher emotional center. And then we have two intellectual centers, the intellectual center and then the higher intellectual center. So Gurdjieff says that we have these higher emotional and intellectual centers, but normally people don't connect with them. And they're within the level or realm of the supernormal. The five lower centers are responsible for all manifestation in ordinary life. I'll pause there, Jim. I've covered psychology of man's possible evolution, study of language, study of oneself, study of the centers. Did you have anything you thought to add on those topics? Or?
No, I think that's good, and I think, you know, you've kind of, it's a nice summary of what we talked about in the last program, and just that it's hard to kind of grasp, like, the difference in what is being suggested here is kind of cumulative in terms of the different elements, but it leads to an entirely different psychology, and it's Uspensky makes a differentiation of psychologies that study man as he is, or rather as people suppose him to be, which is how he typifies modern academic psychology, which began in Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory in the 1870s in Germany, and then the ancient psychologies, which he says psychology is perhaps the oldest science, because it's psychology of transformation has always been associated with various mystical and esoteric practices, everything from alchemy and magic to theosophy in modern times. And he says that these psychologies begin with the study of the laws and principles of the psychology of man's possible evolution, of the idea that people can transform their consciousness and their level of being. So all of these things that he's talking about, these definitions, each of them is important individually, but taken together, this leads to a radically different psychology. Like when you said, I think it's very, very important to understand, like, modern psychology, which is, I think most people who haven't studied modern psychology would probably be surprised by this, but modern psychologists don't study themselves, and they don't teach the value of self-study, because they don't see anything in self-study. They think that it's subjective, whereas in the mystical and esoteric approach, it's only through the study of oneself in terms of some sort of system or set of ideas or practices and disciplines that one can really begin to understand both the nature of consciousness and the self or I experience, and how these aren't set but can be transformed. And that's the essential difference between, I'd say, modern psychology, modern Western experimental and so-called scientific psychology and the ancient psychology. So it's very important to grasp this idea that you have to study yourself, and you have to study yourself systematically. And as you say, when you were talking earlier about the different levels, like what the I can mean, in terms of the different levels of human consciousness and being, that really applies to self, too, because we can study ourselves in our normal waking state, what Gurdjieff calls the waking sleep. We can study people in that level of self, but then there are higher levels of self which are dormant within us and which can be awakened and can be realized through the practices that the esoteric and mystical teachings prescribe. So it's a much more, the esoteric and mystical approach is much more dynamic and contains levels of scale that aren't really recognized within modern psychology. Modern psychology is very simplistic and dualistic in its approach to things, whereas as the esoteric and mystical psychologies recognize the importance of scale and are multidimensional in their approaches.
Yeah, I can't think of anything in modern psychology which has this idea of man's possible evolution. Gurdjieff and Uspensky are saying they don't mean physical evolution, like the changing of the morphology of the body and that. What they're saying is that we can actually undergo a psychical, spiritual evolution and change, fundamental change in our being. And it doesn't mean that our physical form changes, but rather we evolve in terms of acquiring these higher being bodies. So in modern, so human beings in the fourth way, it's Gurdjieff explains that normally human beings are asleep to themselves. They do not know themselves. They're not properly conscious. They don't have true will. Instead, they're conditioned by everything around them, and they're just simply, in a way, mechanical beings controlled by all their associations and internal and external stimuli. They have no inner motor, no real will, no real I. And instead, the human beings have all these negative emotions all the time, which is draining all their energies, and people don't develop in their being. So this whole idea of the psychology of man's possible evolution, like it's a fascinating concept, and it's the basis of, in a way, of all in all the mystical traditions, because they're all saying that we can attain to these higher states of self-realization or objective knowledge or divine knowledge, experiences of the mysteries, experiences of the grounds of being. All of these are latent faculties that human beings could acquire, but under the conditions of ordinary life, people aren't aware of these possibilities. So this whole idea of evolution is really very different than anything you have in the West. They might talk about self-actualization or development of someone or maturation, but not of evolution. So it certainly marks the mystical traditions as something apart from the modern so-called scientific traditions. Which for the past century has denied the existence of human spirit and soul and regarded human beings simply as biological organisms. Okay, whereas Gurdjieff is saying that we do have these spiritual and soul faculties at least latent within us. So then, okay, so we'll come back. So the fourth was the study of the centers, and the next was the study of consciousness. And we had made a number of points about consciousness. One of the ones that Jim and I repeatedly emphasized, in the fourth way, you distinguish consciousness from what they call the psychological functions of thinking, feeling, and sensation, that thinking is not consciousness. Okay, whereas a lot of Western psychologies confuse consciousness with the stream of thought or the streaming of the mind, whereas a mystical tradition, the minding and the intellectual center, that's just one of the contents of one of the centers of which we can be conscious. We can also be conscious of emotions and of sensations. So consciousness is something separate from the psychological functions. And that, in a way, sounds like a very simple point, but it's a point that's kind of been missed in a century of Western psychology, where psychologists routinely equate consciousness with the flow of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and the like, which is a quote from William James. So this idea that consciousness is separate from the psychological functions, and it's compared to light. And it said we could have more or less of this light according to how properly conscious we are. And in Gurdjieff compares these centers, he says, compares to machines. And they can function, how effective they function depends on how much consciousness there is. So if there's more light and more illumination, then the centers can function more effectively. So that's one of the first points, that consciousness is separate from the psychic functions, and it's compared also to light. And this is so important in the mystical tradition, this equation of consciousness with light. And we can see that even in terms like being enlightened, or having an insight is like a flash in the mind, is like this illumination of the mind. Okay, so in the fourth way teaching, is taught that man ordinarily lives in outer darkness and he does not know himself. And so in a way we have to gain this light. We want to, in early Gnostic Christianity, they spoke about light gaining, that we want to learn to live in the light. And as we acquire more consciousness, one actually experiences this kind of greater inward illumination. And another thing consciousness is compared to is a background upon which things are revealed. And in a way, consciousness, I think, can be very usefully compared to space. Now, Gurdjieff doesn't talk exactly in this way, but let me just explain, like, if you look around you in a room, if I look around me in my room and I see all these objects, I see a table and chairs and telephone and a hat and all these things. Now, these things exist in space. Now, what is the nature of that space within which we live and move and have our being? And all these things around me exist within space, but what is that space itself? Now, in a way, space has no color. It has no color. It's kind of empty. It has no color. All the objects have color, but space itself has no color. We can't smell it. We can't taste it. In a way, space is a form of nothing. No thing. It's like no thing, but it's the presence of this nothingness that then allows us to be aware of all the things. See, if there wasn't space, then we couldn't have all the things. So it's like we need the nothingness to enable things to bear their existence. So consciousness, similarly, it's like space. So consciousness, in a way, is a kind of form of nothingness. It's a form of nothingness at the heart of being, and this nothingness then enables us to be aware of all these different things, different thoughts, feelings, sensations, dimensions, other entities, human beings. We can be aware of all these possible different things, but they're things kind of which, and it's the presence of this no-thingness which allows us to be aware of things. And in a way, that's what consciousness is like. It's like this no-thingness at the heart of being. And because there's that no-thingness, we're able to be aware of all these different things. So consciousness, Aleister Crowley says the best symbol for consciousness, and what I use in my work, is a circle with a point in the center. And that point, Crowley calls that hodit. And the hodit is the point star. So that point element is like a divine source emanation or a source of supernal lux, a point of light. And that point exists within the circle. And we color the circle in black. So the black, Crowley calls it nuit, meaning French for night. So Aleister Crowley explains the best symbol for consciousness is a symbol of a point source of light in the blackness of empty space. So in a way, consciousness is like this illumination within space. And because there's that space and illumination, then we can be aware of all the contents of our centers or the objects of our experience. Okay, so I'll, Jim, any other reactions or comments, just staying with the study of consciousness for the moment?
No, I think, you know, well, it's hard to describe, to even try to define what consciousness is, but I like the idea that it's, the central idea is that it's not the psychic functions, and that this, the metaphor, like as Uspensky says, it's like a background. And again, that's like your analogy to space. Like it's something against which the contents of consciousness appear. Like the contents are the ideas and feelings and sensations and images and daydreams and fantasies that we have, like that are going through our minds and are in our consciousness in a sense, and then consciousness, the thing that they're in, is like this background. But the critical distinction is that in Western psychology, the consciousness has been equated with the contents of this so-called stream of experience, as William James termed it, which is still the predominant metaphor in discussions of consciousness. So the focus is on the contents, and since the 70s in Western academic psychology, there's been a particular emphasis through the study of consciousness by cognitive psychologists on thinking and cognitive processes. But what that misses is, as you said, it's those are all psychic functions. In Uspensky's terms, those are psychic functions, and that consciousness as the background is variable, so that we have, and this is what's not recognized at all within Western psychology or modern philosophy of consciousness, is that that background is variable, and that we can equate it, we can liken it to light, like various sources of illumination, various levels of illumination, so that the background can be brighter or it can be dimmer depending on how conscious we are. And so the more conscious we are, the more light is thrown on things. And in a way, that's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's a very useful, I think a very useful model or metaphor for the variability of consciousness within the stream of consciousness. So that's what Gurdjieff says, is that your principal mistake is thinking that you're always conscious or that you're never conscious, that really in our waking state we have this variability of consciousness within ourselves going all the time. Consciousness is much more dynamic than what Western psychologists have recognized, and it has all sorts of inherent transformative dynamics and principles that completely escape Western psychologists, and, or as I was saying earlier, which are the basis of the whole approach of mystical and esoteric sciences to the study of consciousness. So it's really important to understand this idea. You can't stress it enough, is that consciousness is not the contents of the waking experience. It's not the ideas, it's not the thoughts, it's not the feelings, it's not the emotions, it's not the sensations. It's something apart from that. And as you say, that something in some real way is a no-thing. So it's a very important no-thing, but it's a dynamic no-thing, which on one level makes absolutely no sense, but in a way it does as you understand the dynamics more.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a useful comparison to compare consciousness to space, which, like, one can see how, in a way, like, space is this no-thingness. Like, that makes such sense. Eh? It's not, yeah. It has no attributes itself, but it's the presence of space which then allows you to be aware of the things. It's also interesting, you even go back to someone like William James, and William James... he made this distinction between what he called the I and the me, or the I and the it. And he always said, no matter kind of like what we're thinking or feeling, there's always some sense of I, he says, that exists in relationship to the me. So the me might be my own thoughts. So there's some kind of I that exists in the relationship to me. And what happened in modern psychology, they forgot to investigate the I, and they kind of just got rid of the I, and all they focused on was the contents of consciousness, the me side of the equation. And you see that even in people like David Chalmers, who has this kind of distinguishes between what he calls the hard problem of consciousness and the soft problem of consciousness. And he explains it like, scientists can pinpoint different neurological processes that are involved in different cognitive functions or sensory processes. But those, in a way, that's easy, he says, to find these correlations between neurological activity and different functions like cognitions and such. But what we don't understand is the hard problem of consciousness, which is this kind of direct experiencing, this inner I awareness. Like no one can explain kind of what that is. So we understand the it or the me side of the equation, but not the I side. And of course, in modern psychology, no one thinks there is a real I. And that's what's so unusual about mystical teachings, is that they are actually suggesting that there is some kind of individualized I. Like Gurdjieff would say, it's that your I is the kernel of your essence. Okay, so in other traditions, you might say a human being has a God spark within them, or a divine spark. So the idea in mystical teachings is that there is this particular special element, a monad in hyperspace for Blavatsky, or in the Vedas it's a jiva atma, the individual self within the heart, which is described as self-luminous like the sun. And in yogic teachings, they describe the light of the jiva atma in the heart is then distributed through the blood all through the body. And it's related, and that's how consciousness and sentience is spread through the body, through the blood and the breath. So in mystical teaching, there is this idea that human beings actually do have this hidden, unknown self. And it's related in a way to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. So Gurdjieff doesn't explain it in those terms, but it's consistent with those terms. For Gurdjieff to attain I, or true I in a human being, we have to awaken what he calls the higher emotional center, and which I would say is related to the heart. And in Beelzebub's Tales, Gurdjieff explains to his grandson that the three-brained beings on planet Earth are supposed to be very abnormal because of, well, we'll explore that next week when we go into the tales. I'm partly forgetting what I was trying to come to here, Jim. Could you help me out?
Something about these, like the idea of an essence or a spark or an I principle. That's what you were coming from.
Oh yeah, and I was saying Gurdjieff doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't talk quite in that term. In terms of the awakening of the heart, he talks about the awakening of the higher emotional center, and that our I is connected to the higher emotional center. So that is what I'm saying is related to the heart, but not simply the physical heart. What Gurdjieff means, in a way, it's the spiritual heart center. It's a higher emotional center. So,
yeah, and in a way, too, it's interesting because in his teaching, he talks, in the earlier years of his teaching, he talked about the process of self-remembering and of trying to have moments in which one is more aware of oneself being here in this moment, and just that trying to remember to have to make that effort, and then trying to have those moments in which one does remember oneself a little bit more and wakes up to the situation in which one is, and tries to have this experience of oneself. And then later in his later years, he put a lot of emphasis on the importance of the having the I experience several times a day, trying to remember, like he didn't even say remember, he said try to be aware of your I and in your chest, and he emphasized it more in those terms in later times. But all of this is related, as you say, to the idea of the higher emotional center in his teaching, and it's related to the idea of trying to develop something that's within us, which is dormant and which is occluded by our normal waking state of consciousness, and that we have to try to gain clarity and to gain harmony and balance within ourselves to realize this. But it's there all the time. We just can't experience it because of the improper state of our normal waking consciousness. So in Gurdjieff, it's kind of funny because it's hidden in a way, but he's leading you to this idea. He doesn't emphasize it in the same way as say, like the Vedic teachings of the Jiva Atma or in Blavatsky, but it's certainly there. Again, the contrast is so dramatic with all of the ideas in modern Western science and psychology about what the nature of consciousness is that because it begins with the assumption, and it's an assumption that consciousness is somehow manufactured or produced or emerges because of the operation of the electrochemical, neurological processes in the human brain. That's what produces consciousness. And that is an assumption. That's what's forgotten. It's a very important assumption, but it's also an assumption that goes along with a view of the universe as being something out there that consists of really this non-sentient, just dumb matter that's interacting mechanically throughout the universe. And within mystical and esoteric teachings, that's entirely contrary, because again, they have this level of this idea of the level of scales, and that there are these higher dimensions which are interpenetrating lower dimensions and which are informing them, and which are the source of consciousness and life, and that really everything is coming out of this unity and being stepped down on various levels, and the human being, this arises, the life and consciousness principles arise through these higher dimensions, being stepped down and manifesting through the human heart and the higher dimensions of the human heart. So it's a radically different perspective about not only the nature of human beings and the I experience, but really of the entire structure of reality in the universe. It's a completely different viewpoint, radically different viewpoint.
Yeah, it really takes time to grok how really different it is. One thing I think one way Gurdjieff explains it sometimes in Beelzebub's Tales, he describes how human beings, how their true consciousness has passed into what they call their unconscious or the subconscious. So it's like our true consciousness, like the consciousness of I and the consciousness of the heart, it's still there, but we form this outer mask or a persona, which becomes more dominant, and Gurdjieff describes it as a false consciousness system, which is centered more in the mind, in the head, in what he calls the formatory apparatus, which is like the mechanical part of the mind. So he says our true consciousness passes into the subconscious, and we acquire this false consciousness system. So what we have to do, in a way, is break down the false consciousness system to get back to our essential life consciousness, which in a way is there all the time, but in a way we've forgotten it. In a way, it's like Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden, that we've kind of lost this experience, this kind of ecstatic experience of I within the heart. It is described as an ecstatic experience. And yogis describe the bliss sheath in the heart. And the more we live in the heart, there's that inner blissfulness that one experiences. So we've kind of lost this essential consciousness, and we have to regain it. And I just had one other thing here. I coming back to the subject of consciousness and light, I have this quote, which I think is very useful, from Maurice Nickel, who is a psychologist and student of Gurdjieff and Uspensky. And he writes, "In this system, what we seek above all things is light. And light means consciousness. We seek to live more consciously and to become more conscious. We live in darkness owing to the lack of light, the light of consciousness. And we seek in this work light on ourselves. Everything that this system says about work on yourself, on oneself, about self-remembering, about struggling with negative emotions, about internal considering, about self-justification, and so on, has as its supreme aim to make a man more conscious, to let light dawn in him. And it is a very strange thing, this light. It is first to become more conscious of oneself, and then more conscious of others. This is a strange experience. I mean by this that the direction in which the work leads you through increasing consciousness, increasing light, is not at all the direction you might imagine as a person asleep, a person who knows only ordinary consciousness. To become conscious of others is just as strange and even more strange. The life you yourself lead with passions and jealousies, meannesses, dislikes, and hatreds becomes utterly ridiculous. You wonder, in fact, what on earth have you been doing all your life? Have you been insane? You ask yourself. Yes, exactly. In the deep sleep we live in the light of the kingdom of heaven, we are all utterly insane and do not know what we are doing. The work begins to teach you what to do. To awaken, that is the object of this work." So I think that's a beautiful description of light, what it means in a way to let more, to have that increased light in the inner world, where you start becoming more aware of your own thoughts and emotional patterns. You start shining this light on in your inner world, and it's an amazing process when you begin to do this. And you, like Nichols says, you see all your jealousies and envies and negative emotions and internal considering, like all these are the things we try to observe in the Gurdjieff work. We try to observe these things in ourselves and struggle in a way to be free of them. And so it's a very nice analogy for like light and how, as we become more conscious, it's like there's increasing inner illumination, and many of the things which ordinarily might go on, as you become conscious of it, it kind of dissolves it. You can't, like, if you could see your pettiness in things, as you become conscious of that, in a way you can release it and learn to not be identified. And it's like you separate the I from the it more and more, and the I begins to observe the it. And that process can increase, and there can be an increasing inner illumination. Yeah, you see so much, Jim, everybody uses the metaphor of consciousness as light, even in Western psychology, like Julian James and so many people compare consciousness and light as light, but no one ever kind of considers, well, let's take that seriously, kind of. Well, that, you know, because light is a material, natural phenomena, so we can understand light. So, you know, to view consciousness as light is like it's a perspective, it's a scientific hypothesis. You know, it's a very useful kind of way of thinking about consciousness, that somehow there is this inner light illumination, and that is the source of our inner awareness of being. Whereas in Western psychology, no one thinks that there's really light in your inner world in that way. I've never heard anyone talk in those words as such.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, there's different levels to it. The problem in part is because it's meant in different ways. Like it's like as Nichols says, it's a good metaphor to the idea of light as a metaphor for consciousness is applicable. But also within the mystical and esoteric teachings, they also mean, well, there's light. There's the light. Metaphorically, but then there's the light of the electromagnetic spectrum, and then there's the light, which is the supernal light of the higher dimensions, which is related to experiences of spiritual illumination and enlightenment. And there's that recurring metaphor within all of the sacred literature about being illuminated or enlightened, which is also experienced by people who have transformative mystical experiences of consciousness, and also people who have near-death experiences. So it seems to be a recurring and also psychedelic experiences with certain drugs. So it's a recurring metaphor, but it's also a recurring, like Aldous Huxley said in a speech about the visionary experience. He said, you know, that he talks about this recurring idea. It's a quasi sensual element too. There's actually something to it physically. It's not just a metaphor. So there's this whole other aspect, and nobody, as you say, really considers within Western psychology that it has something to do essentially with the inner experience of consciousness. I like that Nichols quote is that we've probably been using that, both of us, in our writing for more than 30 years, and I think I remember when I first read that it was in the first years that I had studied the Gurdjieff teaching, and it's exactly as he said. It's such a dramatic experience to begin to suspect that maybe everything that you thought you knew and everything that you thought everybody else knew is not only wrong, but that in some way we're all quite insane, or that, you know, we've been mad all our lives because we've misunderstood things so fundamentally. So there's that aspect to it, and then there's the other aspect is something that Gurdjieff touched on when he said that, when he's talking about the the dynamics of interchange and awakening, and he says it's like it's an alchemical process. And he says that we observe in nature there are various processes that can only occur in nature in the absence of light, and that if you introduce light into these processes, it actually changes the chemistry of things and the dynamics of organic processes. And he says it's exactly the same thing psychologically, is that the light of consciousness actually changes things, like just by being present. And I think that both of us observe that when you begin to observe yourself systematically, and you begin to try to remember yourself systematically, there are just the process of observing and trying to remember, it does introduce an element, something that's, it's not just metaphorical. It's seen something substantive, which changes certain processes, and certain things just drop away in and of themselves because you've made that effort. It's a very peculiar and inspiring dynamic, and in a way, it gives you a hint as to why Gurdjieff says that man cannot, in his normal state, understand, even imagine what he's capable of realizing if he were to awaken and develop himself properly. And I think that's part of the dynamics of self-study and the striving for self-change, is that you see the fantastic obstacles you have to overcome, but on the other hand, you see that even the most basic efforts does introduce these really significant changes into your own experience of yourself and the world.
Well, I think that comment brings us right to our next definition of psychology, and this is that psychology has to begin with self-remembering. And this ties into the study of consciousness, because self-remembering, now, it's a practice, or it can also be used to describe a state of being in the state of self-remembering, but it is a practice we use in order to study consciousness in ourselves. And the idea of this is, I think, where we ended our last show last week, Jim. And I remember last week I encouraged your listeners to try to remember themselves through the two-week period. And if there are listeners back here again today who were listening to the show 2 weeks ago, you know, I would ask, did you remember yourself? Did you remember through your last weeks at certain times in your day to kind of come back to just being awake and present in the moment of being here now and trying to sense yourself fully, emotionally, physically, mentally, simultaneously? So you have a presence, a three-centered presence, okay? And to have moments of this kind of heightened wakefulness at different points in our days and weeks. Sorry, Jim?
Did you remember yourself?
Well, I think I do it all the time now, every day, because I've done it for 40 years, and it's developed something in me that I don't forget myself in the same way as I used to, and I observe my own inner processes a lot, and you know, so I think it's had an effect on me. But
yeah,
in terms of actually doing it and connecting it back to my instructions on that day, not really so, because I just do it as part of my living process now.
Yeah, it's funny because I think I do it too. I think exactly what you're describing. I think it's become sort of a part of me that you know. But in a way, I think it's become somewhat automatized in me too. It's an aspect of me. But I don't have that feeling of, oh, I am here, you know, in this moment, experiencing and thinking and feeling and acting in these ways. But I do have moments where I'm confronted by things, and they remind me that, you know, I can just go along and be an it, or I can actually wake up and try to work with these things, or try to, you know, not react to them mechanically and habitually. So it's an interesting dynamic. I don't think I, during the time that since the last two programs, for the last program 2 weeks ago, that I really remembered that moment and remembered that aim and with respect to that. But again, that just proves how difficult it is to do.
Yeah. I mean, they tell that story about self-remembering, like someone's died and they're arriving in heaven, and they're asked, did you remember yourself? And the notion is that if you really remembered yourself, you'd say no, that you forgot. because really, one can't remember themselves initially, especially when you begin. You can't there's no constant I in the person can set this intention to be aware of yourself and can maintain that awareness through your day. Because all the time, different things happen that automatically engage different associative thinking or different aspects of your personality and makeup. So we always have like shifting from one eye to another little eye. We don't have a constancy of eye that a person could set the intention to self-remember and then follow through and actually do it. Instead, when we begin to self-remember, what we begin to see is how hard it is to do it. Because all the time we get caught up in everything around us and the things we got on our mind and our emotional concerns and our relationships. And we always have all these things on the minds all the time. And self-remembering then is a process by which we begin to study this of how we get so caught up and forget ourselves all the time. And over time, we continue to come back to this self-remembering. And over time, it builds something in the person. And at a later point, we'll talk a little bit, Jim, about like the deputy steward and the steward and things like that, that Gurdjieff explains as steps on the path, kind of. But anyway, this process then of self-remembering. And it's a thrilling process. I think, Jim, when we began studying this material and working on ourselves along this line, that was an absolutely magical period for me. And well, I know for both of us, because we've talked about this before, when we were having so many insights from studying ourselves and remembering ourselves. And it was like it introduces a whole new dimension to life. Because no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, you can kind of self-remember. And when you have those moments of self-remembering, and it's like you got this whole inner world that you become aware of that normally you just were caught up in everything, but you start becoming an observer of yourself. And it's a fascinating process. And part of it also, it connects into a lot of other things we try to do in the fourth way, like the struggle against negative emotions. Like for Gurdjieff, we want to rid ourselves of negative emotions as much as this is possible. So we begin to observe our own negative emotions when they arise, if we can remember to do it. And then you can have moments where you can observe your own pattern of negative emotion and the kind of thinking that goes with it, and how in your own mind you justify your negative emotion in some circumstance. And then you have moments where you become aware of all this going on in your inner world. And it's like my experience was that I could not go with it. I could disarm that negative emotion. I didn't have to feel those things. I could let it go. I could breathe through it. I could release it. And it was like things that would normally have kind of preoccupied me, and I would have ruminated about them in my mind and internally considered them and in my mind talked to that person why they're such an idiot and why I'm so clever or whatever, you know, all the things that go on in our inner world. And then all of a sudden, it's like I could see patterns of that and just let them go and not do it and just come back. And it was like every time I did that, it was like a boost of energy, because all the energy invested in that, you could just retain that energy. And it's like in Buddhism, you try to end attachments to things. So it's like you're kind of disidentifying. You're separating the I from the it. And it's an absolutely fascinating process. And I remember that was such a thrilling time in our life, I think both of us, Jim, how when we began to discover and apply the fourth way teaching, like it really quite dramatically changed our lives.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, still is. And, it was over a period of several years, too. But as you say, for me, like, I had studied some aspects of Buddhism before the fourth way, and I understood the idea, the concept of attachment and trying to free yourself of attachment. like from the fourth way perspective, when you're trying to self-remember, I realized to me that was a much more practical, like it was a method that challenged all of my identifications, which is essentially the same thing as attachments, and I could see how emotionally invested I was in all of these things that really happened in me, that they weren't things that I did, they just were automatic and habitual responses to things and not something that I did. And I mean, I think that's a huge thing, is to realize that, you know, in Gurdjieff's teaching, he says everything happens and we cannot do, and what little we can do is we can make this effort to try to come to from time to time. And it's like I began to realize, I think from the beginning when I did this, what real magic would be to actually to be able to do would constitute real magic. And there was really a magical aspect to all of this, in the sense that it was like awakening from a dream or realizing that everything is happening in a dream, and that you've come to and understood something that most people don't understand at all. And it's like, in a way, it's exciting and it's inspiring, but it's also horrifying. So there's like this double aspect to it. And you realize that there's a certain responsibility, that the more that you come to understand this, you have to do something with it. Like, you can't just sort of think, oh, well, you know, now I know this and that's good enough. And no, you have to work. You actually have to strive to go beyond that initial understanding. And it, the more effort you put into it, the more consciously you try to pursue this understanding of things, the more you're rewarded, the more you understand. It's just like what I was saying at the beginning of the program. You begin to connect things and see things in much greater depth. Even the experience of trying to remember yourself, I think, becomes deeper and takes on a different quality as you do it. Like, self-remembering is like, it's like consciousness, a very elusive concept in a way. In a way, it's simple when you begin it, but the more you do it, the more you realize, no, it's not simple at all. It's multidimensional. Like, for years, I tried to remember myself, and I thought of it in terms of like trying to be aware of my thoughts and feelings and actions and emotional reactions and how I was acting, and try to be aware of myself being here. And that is part of it. But then I realized, I read something that Gurdjieff said, well, which self do you want to remember? And then I realized, well, there's this whole other aspect to it. Like, I think his question refers to the idea of, like, there's this higher objective element within us, which is the real self, in which we're not normally aware of, like, as you say, it's passed into our subconscious, and it's there, but it's dormant, so we don't understand it, we don't know it, we don't realize how we're normally identified with the false self and our false system of consciousness, in which we, you know, we can think and act, and we can achieve, we can write books, we can, you know, create great things, we can be saluted as being accomplished individuals. But all of this, in a way, once you begin to see it, you realize this is all happening, and that it's not real. It's not real consciousness. It's all part of this level of existence, which is we take to be normal, but which is really not normal, and that there are levels above this where if people were really properly conscious, they would act and think and feel quite differently. And so,
yeah, it's like we become so dominated by automated patterns of conditioning in each of the centers. So conditioned patterns of thinking, feeling, and reaction. And in a way, that's what Gurdjieff explains. It's like we become automatons, and we're under the control of internal and external stimuli all the time. So we don't have any real I or any real inner motor, and we can't really direct our own being functions. Instead, we're, you know, one stimulus happens and it engages our attention, and that evokes automated thoughts, and those evoke other emotions, and then a woman walks by and your sexual center's aroused and you loll after her, and then something else happens, and it's like a dog, taken by every scent or everything that happens, you know. And that's what human beings are like. We're always lost in whatever is happening. And so self-remembering is an effort to kind of come back to yourself and be present and be aware of what's going on within you and also around you. And as you say, there's an important distinction in a way between self-observation and self-remembering. Because self-observation is where we try to separate the I from the it. And we observe, like, we're aware of our own pattern of negative emotions, or as an example. And we observe that. But to self-remember, see, in a way, we want to self-remember at the same time we self-observe. And that's what you were getting at a moment ago, Jim. It's like what Gurdjieff says, well, what kind of I is present when you're self-observing? You know, and if we're self-remembering, then that's to enhance the awareness of the I element. And in a way, we want to heighten that I awareness while we observe ourselves. And just another thought to go back a little bit. I was thinking that another kind of influence that, you know, when I came across the Gurdjieff teaching, I was in clinical psychology, and I was, you know, we had to read Bandura's Principles of Behavior Modification, kind of the classic book on kind of behavioral, classical and respondent conditioning and modeling, and this is a very big book back in those days. And it was so interesting how in behaviorism, the fundamental enigma that no one really knew how to address was this issue of consciousness. And in this kind of classic book by Bandura, he had only a couple lines on consciousness, but saying like how it was this kind of like completely unsolvable kind of enigma. No one really understood the consciousness. But what's so important, I realized, is that the development of consciousness is what allows a person to overcome their patterns of conditioning. See, this is in the behaviorist equation. They couldn't deal with that consciousness. But it's like when a person attains consciousness, that can free them of that pattern of conditioning. So consciousness is like this means by which we can escape of this automaticity of our own thoughts and feelings and this mechanical state. It's consciousness which is this... I'm not sure. It's this kind of agent of change in a way. It allows us to overcome the patterns of conditioning. And I was interested in psychotherapy. And in psychotherapy, like, the whole idea is that we've got to bring the unconscious into consciousness and help people develop in their consciousness. So it's the development of consciousness. Like the idea is you have things repressed in your subconscious. So if those can be brought into consciousness so that once again you're aware of those, then it helps you resolve those issues and release them. But until they're brought, so consciousness is when things are brought into consciousness, that's what undermines the conditioning.
Yeah, but I think in the behavioral approach, I think what they were arguing is that really rather than trying to understand they do in psychoanalysis, right? Rather than trying to explore the dynamics of consciousness, you simply recondition somebody by conditioning them in a new way in order to overcome problematic conditioning. So really, like for them, consciousness doesn't really sort of exist. And behaviorism started by denying that, you know, consciousness was a useful or, you know, a necessary concept. And really, like I think in the Bandura case, like most of those studies are like basically they're describing principles, but they're the same principles as create inappropriate conditioning can create appropriate conditioning. And then I think what that led to was in the behavioral approach to psychotherapy is that people began to realize, well, you know, it's not just simply a matter of conditioning. We have to take into effect affect, and then we have to take into effect behavior. I mean, it actually went the other way. It was behavior, cognition, and affect, and then so you had the ABC approach of psychotherapy according to behavior modification, and that's affect, behavior, and cognition. So there was a recognition, but their mistake, I think, was to focus again, like you're looking at these processes, but you're not looking at consciousness. Like you're looking at the contents, but you're not really looking, and you're trying to create sort of a horizontal change. And I think that's true of almost all modern psychotherapy. There's not an emphasis on transformation. It's all horizontal. It's like we'll replace inappropriate or problematic conditioning and automaticity of affect, behavior, and cognition, and we'll replace it with more functional and less distressful affect, behavior, and cognition conditioning. But it's all horizontal. It's the same thing. There's no recognition that there's something beyond that which could affect a much more fundamental change. And that so it's like, in a way, as I say, I think to go back to your earlier discussion, I think it's more on the me, in William James's term, and still the I experience is not addressed. I mean, it was only like a few years ago I really it just sort of struck me one day when I was thinking about this, is like how the whole of Western psychology has really ignored the I experience. I mean, really, other than the psychoanalysts and the ego psychologists that came after Freud, you have some examination of the I experience, but really, most of Western psychology completely ignores it. I mean, it goes hand in hand when you realize that most of Western psychology is based on an ignoring of consciousness, but it's really such a fundamentally different approach to things. Like you say, they've just washed this away and not really touched on it at all, and yet it's so central to everything. And again, to go back to what I was saying earlier, when you place the I experience and the approach to it within an esoteric perspective, it takes on all these different meanings, because they have this multidimensional notion of what it means to be a human being, and a multidimensional notion of the universe, and then they have this connection between the multidimensional realities that a human being can experience and multidimensional realities that exist beyond the material plane. So it enlarges into this much more complex and dynamic perspective, and it's so strikingly at odds with this simplistic approach in Western psychology, which is basically just to deny that, you know, that the I experience is important. But that's because psychologists don't study themselves. They don't understand how important the I experience really is.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so interesting how the alternative perspective of seeing consciousness as connected to the heart and the blood flow and the types of things we speak about, there's so many aspects of that can be verified through self-study in a way. Like, it reminds me of like the pointing game. When I lecture, I used to kind of say to people, okay, point to a wall, point to the ceiling, point to your left foot, point to your right ear, and then I'd say, point to yourself. And the vast majority of people, when they kind of point to themselves, they indicate towards the region of their heart, and sometimes up more towards their throat, as though they're not sure whether they should be pointing to their heart or to the mind in the head. But very, very few people point to themselves by pointing to their head. I mean, even to see someone do it, it looks almost bizarre, like point to yourself. If someone points to their head, like, there's something weird about that person, you know. Or it's like the natives thought white men were crazy because white men thought they thought with their heads and they didn't realize that you thought with your hearts, kind of. And this is in native teaching, you know.
The Hopi.
And so here we have this, like, it's a clinical observation that I've done, is groups of people pointing to themselves. No one ever points to their heads, you know. The by far the greater majority point towards the heart area to indicate I. Okay, now if all our consciousness and self are all up in the head being produced by the brain, like the scientists say, why isn't everybody pointing up to their heads? Because they don't. Because they directly intuit, I would say, self within the heart. So they this is a direct intuition. No one ever teaches you, if you're asked to point to yourself, I want you to point here or there. Like, you're not taught that. It's just when people do it spontaneously, they point to their heart. And even when people speaking and they're speaking from themselves, the way they use their hands, you can see how they indicate their heart. When, if it's heartfelt or, you know, feelings from the heart. See, people don't realize, like, how bizarre Western psychology is, really, with its head doctrine. Like, even the idea in Western psychology now, they think, you know, our emotional states have to do with the limbic system, with the midbrain area, like the fornix and the amygdala body and all these midbrain structures. And they stimulate rats in that region and cause them to go into rages and different emotions. So they kind of think this midbrain structure is the center of emotions. So the modern scientists think the emotional center is kind of up in the brain. But it's like, you know, as we say, like, how many people go home and tell your partner that you love them with all your head? You know, it would sound insane if you said that to someone, that you love them with all your head, or if you love them with all your limbic system. Or would you refer to your sweet head instead of your sweetheart, you know? Or would you put a picture of a brain on a Valentine? You know, and here's all my brain, you know. I love you with all my brain. You know, see, in a way, people know intuitively. Sergio?
There's an argument against that, too, is that, you know, that I think that certain Western scientists would argue, well, those are just cultural constructs that we've created to represent emotions. And I mean, the question remains, why has that construct been created? But, you know, I guess there is that argument. The other thing,
yeah,
too, is if somebody gets whacked in the head, which I write about a lot, about people who have serious head injuries, it's very, very common for them to undergo profound changes in their emotional presence and their emotional reactivity and their emotional states. And so it's like there are definitely processes and structures in the brain that do regulate emotions and are related to emotions. But the argument is that they're not centered there. That's not the locus or concentration of your emotions, and that. The problem is that Western scientists tend to treat people as if they were sort of just these brains who have these bodies that are somehow connected but not really important or necessary to what it means to be a human being. Like, again, Crick's thing, we're all just a pack of neurons, you know. There's such an emphasis on the brain. Now, the other side in reply to that comment about a construct is that there's physical evidence in that the field in the heart is 5,000 times stronger. The electromagnetic field in the heart is 5,000 times stronger than that in the brain, which is a good physical basis for people to point to themselves. Why don't people point to their kneecaps? Why don't they point to their feet? Why don't they point to their arms?
I've had one person out of many thousands point to his genitals. You know, I thought, oh, I'm Freudian.
I'm actually surprised that there are not more people who point to their genitals. But I mean, that's a very interesting, it's a very interesting exercise. And I think it's one of those, like, really quite brilliant, simplistic but quite brilliant little psychological experiments. I mean, I think that's a legitimate psychological experiment. I think the results are very, very telling. And then there's the whole idea, again, which is like, I mean, you can make the argument, well, you know, without a brain, you won't have any, you know, feelings or thoughts or anything. But without a heart, you won't have anything either. You know, like, I mean, you have to have I mean, this whole idea about the importance, I think one of the most important ideas, and this is something you emphasize in your work that comes from esotericism, is the importance of blood flow as how that relates to consciousness. Because, and Western science recognizes that with respect to the brain, but blood flow is just critical because everything in terms of how you experience things consciously is related to blood flow. If you get sexually excited, you're not in your brain, you're in your genitals because there's an increased blood flow there. And I mean, you've used the example, you know, you have a heavy meal and, you know, you have a decreased blood flow. If you lie on your arm and you lose feeling in your arm because you've been lying on it, it's because you've cut off the flow of blood. Your actual, you know, physical sensation of your arm is gone. I mean,
yeah, that's a good example. Yeah, you cut off the blood flow to your arm. It goes numb and you have no sensation in it. Yeah.
You have no consciousness of having an arm, you know. I mean, it's very basic. I mean, and you know, you can increase blood flow to your feet or to your toes, or to your hands, you know, just by concentrating on it. It's easy to alter blood flow within yourself. I mean, that, you know, and so it's much, much more complicated. As I said, I thought I came up with this, but I read it in Rupert Sheldrake's book too. But most Western scientists tend to treat people as if they're disembodied beings. That they just these head things that, you know, are attached to these bodies that are essentially there to, you know, eat and feed themselves and get around town and have sex from time to time. But I mean, it's like there's no anything essential about the body, but it's obviously much, much more complicated in terms of our consciousness, because our consciousness is distributed throughout the body like it is. It's just silly to even pretend that it isn't. So, you know, it's a much more sophisticated. We have all these different systems. You know, you have a vascular system, which is incredibly important. You have a musculoskeletal system, which is incredibly important. You know, you have an endocrine system, and you know, like all of these systems are interrelated, and they're not focused in the head. I mean, it's completely idiotic.
The heart has its own electrical system, and it's not controlled by the brain. It is separate, because, I mean, you can take a heart out of a chest and it continues to beat because it has its own electrical system.
Yeah, there are more nerve cells in your stomach than there are in your brain. You know, like neurons don't just exist in your brain. So I mean, it's ludicrous to it's interesting because this is developed in Western science in the last 100 years especially. But there's this we're incredibly focused on the brain. But as Paul Pearsall said, you know, the guy the author of The Heart's Code says, you know, that if the 20th century was the century of the brain, the 21st century will be the century of the heart. And I think that some people are waking up to this. And oddly enough, I mean, I think one of the most compelling bodies of scientific evidence has come about ironically, by the development of improvements in cardiac resuscitation technology. And you have these increasing numbers of people who have these near-death experiences where they've been pronounced clinically dead and where they have a continuation of their consciousness, and then they come back and they describe what they experience, and there's a consistency in the protocols. They're not all exactly the same, but there's certainly a consistency in what people experience, and lo and behold, it's that first that consciousness can exist apart from the functioning of the brain, and that there are experiences of these other dimensions that people consistently provide the same descriptions of, wherein one of the essential features is the experience of light. So, you know, it's so interesting that medical science, in a way, has, as I say, it's almost inverted, it's a side effect of the improvement in cardiac resuscitation technology, but it was cardiac resuscitation technology
which
produced this breakthrough, which is so interesting, you know.
Yeah, because it was because of the heart stoppage that the soul seems to be leave the body or is ejected from the body. That seems a critical thing. I mean, people also have out-of-body experiences when they have the head injuries too. And the dynamics of it, I think, are different then. But especially when people's heart stops and they're revived, then those are the occasions where they report these out-of-body experiences and you know, down traveling down a tunnel of light, or review of their life is another thing. Sometimes people experience levels of illumination, and they can see the patterns of their life and things like this. And yeah, so.
And again, one of the features of that experience, which is so interesting, and which is, you know, I think again is it's a major challenge to our understanding of everything, is how often people say they lose their fear of death because of these experiences.
Yeah.
And they have this knowledge. They have this. Another thing too that I read this book about near death experiences, and one of the things that really struck me in this work was that how many people, it's not a lot of people, but it's certainly enough people that you know, it's intriguing that some people in their life review not only have a review of their own life, but they have this awareness of how their actions and their deeds have affected others that they've known. So they have this kind of, you know, in holographic terms, it's like this multi-holographic experience of not only their own consciousness and the review of their own consciousness, but somehow they know how this affected other people. I find that incredibly fascinating that people board that. If it was one person, it would be one thing, but I think it's fairly frequently. It's not like a 50% or anything like that. But I think there's enough evidence that this has happened to several people that it's certainly an intriguing experience that people would have. And again, this may be related to the developmental level of the person that's having it. That, you know, they have this kind of sophisticated, even more sophisticated, life review.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting how the Dalai Lama explains the death process, I think, is fascinating. And according to Tibetan Buddhism, there's said to be 72,000 channels or nadis in the body, this complex, subtle anatomy. And the nadis are these winds, which are like part of the ethers, and they carry... distribute the vitality through the body. So when life comes into the body, according to the Dalai Lama's teaching, it begins at what's called the indestructible drop within the heart, which is constant throughout the life of the physical organism. And from the indestructible drop, the life energies circulate through the three channels, the Ida, Pingala, and Sushumna, and they're distributed to the system of seven chakras. So when life comes into the body, it emerges within without from the heart into this system of the channels and the chakras. And then when life withdraws, it's said that first the energies, our hands and feet get cold, and the subtle energies, they withdraw into the side channels, the Ida and Pingala. And then these withdraw into the central channel, and then all the energies at death gather into the heart again, return into the heart. The Dalai Lama explains that it's as this happens that we have this access, like, to seeing the patterns of our life, and the memory of our life can flash before us. It's almost, well, I would say in death, the heart functions in a way as a black hole computer. And as our consciousness withdraws into that zero-point dimension, it's like these patterns, these quantum information fields, can be illuminated by the light of the self as our consciousness, you know, passes into these deeper levels. So I think that, you know, it's this kind of concept that the heart is kind of a multidimensional entity. And in a way, it functions like a black hole computer. And we didn't, that's such a complex idea. We didn't continue with our studies of Blavatsky to go into that. We'll come back to that one day, because her idea of a monad is like this little element established in hyperspace. And it has these seven holes dug in space, like seven zero points. And it's like this little element with these holes dug in it. And in a way, in the modern models of holographic physics, what it's like is a mini black hole processor. It's an information processor. So the heart, I would say, somehow acts like a black hole computer. So there's an actual science to this, and when people, their life passes before them at death, this is from the subtle energies again withdrawing into this what did I say, the Dalai Lama, indestructible drop within the heart. Yeah. So let's come back a bit. We were going through the definitions, and we were talking about self-remembering. So we'll just pick up with that and we'll try to get... Sorry, Jim?
All of this came from self-remembering, you know, because our associations to the idea of self-remembering are so varied and so complex,
mm-hmm.
that all of this discussion, I mean, we've gone, a million miles away in a sense, but in a way, this is all related to this whole idea of remembering yourself, of this practice of remembering yourself and what it begins to reveal about the illusions of consciousness, and at the same time the properties of consciousness that can be attained through the practice of systematic self-study and an attempt to awaken.
Yeah. It's funny how the definitions, everything kind of ties into everything and helps. But self-remembering is like this.
Yeah, they all reinforce one another, right? And amplify one another too, like, yeah. Yeah,
and also to understand self-remembering, it's like what people, when they first begin to do it, they think that self-remembering is like thinking about themselves. That's a very common mistake, and people will say to me, well, I don't want to go about my day thinking about myself all the time. But in a way, no, self-remembering is the exact opposite. People ordinarily go around they're thinking about themselves all the day.
Yeah.
When you self-remember, it's like you're trying to break out of that habitual pattern of thinking about yourself and to stop thinking. And in self-remembering, you try to bring your awareness into your body. Like Gurdjieff says, it begins with self-sensing. So I try, when I self-remember, I try to feel my feet in my shoes or on the floor or whatever, and feel my hands. I try to sense myself all through myself physically, and to anchor your self-awareness in your physicalness. And he calls that self-sensing. And then as Jim, you mentioned earlier, Jim, like I'll tap myself over the chest now to try to kind of bring my awareness to my heart area and kind of feel myself there to help me kind of, you want to enhance this I awareness in that moment. So I tap myself over the chest to kind of help increase that awareness. So self-remembering, it's not a process centered in your head in thinking and cognition. That's not what it is. It's trying to have this state of heightened inner self-awareness, being self-awareness. And then you try to have moments like this whenever you remember to do it. And then over time, you can have deeper moments of self-remembering, and it's a process that develops in you. And I know for years, our understanding of what self-remembering was would change, and we'd understand it in a more subtle and sophisticated way over time. Like I remember we used to talk about how you can self-remember in a different hydrogen, and that's a complex notion. But in the Gurdjieff teaching, the world is composed of hydrogens or elements of all different densities. So if we can self-remember in a different hydrogen, it's like we're aware at a more subtle vibratory level of things. And if we accumulate more of these energies in our higher being bodies, then as you self-remember, then there's a different quality to your self-remembering than when you first begin to do it. So... But then, anyway, it is complex, and if you're on my website at zeropoint.ca, if you go to the book on psychological illusions, I have my chapter from the book up on the site on self-remembering, so you can find your way to that if you'd like to read some more material on it. Okay, the next definition of
Before we go on, I just wanted to say one thing about self-remembering. From what you just said there is like people say, oh, I don't want to think about myself, but most of the time we are thinking about ourselves, and we're thinking about it, we're identified with ourselves, and in a way, like, self-remembering is self-forgetting, because it's an attempt to disidentify and just simply have the experience of I am here, and something separate from your thinking and acting and feeling and sensing, like you want to be aware of yourself being aware in a sense. So it's like adding this kind of dimension. Gurdjieff says it doubles the impressions that are received by the different centers. So you have a feeling of sort of the more vividness of your experience. And people have experiences of self-remembering involuntarily when they're in moments of great danger, or sometimes when they're traveling, and even the experience of time itself can be altered when you're remembering yourself, really remembering yourself, and so in a way, it's self-remembering is not thinking about yourself, not being identified with yourself. So in a sense, it is self-forgetting as much as it is anything, and it allows you to be more directly aware of yourself and your thinking and feeling and acting, and of the world. So as I say, it becomes a much more intense kind of experience, and you can actually be aware of it in a sensory sense, that everything seems more intense and vivid.
Yeah, Gurdjieff said that. Someone asked him, well, what's self-remembering like? And he says, everything more vivid.
Yeah.
I think that's from Patterson's book. It's a nice quote.
I thought it was self-remembering, but it's actually, I think it might be actually be in essence, everything is more vivid. But I think it's actually, at one point he said that about self-remembering.
Oh.
But that's certainly my experience of it. But you are more in essence when you are self-remembering. So, you know,
half a dozen
of another, really. But that is the experience. And I think that's what's so odd about it, is that, especially when you first start to try to do it, that's what kind of is inspiring about it, is that you realize, oh, I could have a much more intense and real experience of myself and my life if I was in this state all the time. Problem is that you can't stay in it, but it's certainly, the experience is so distinct that you want to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to introduce into one's life. It's like you add this whole new dimension to your being existence. You know, because you're kind of in the world, but not of it in a way, because you start inwardly to separate a little bit. You're not just controlled by everything that happens all the time. You start developing this inner wakefulness. And okay, so the next definition of psychology, Uspensky says, it involves the study of lying. And here he doesn't simply mean lying where a person intentionally deceives himself or another, but rather lying refers to kind of thinking or assuming that we're in the know and that we know all these kinds of things, which knowledge, from the Gurdjieff and Uspensky perspective, most of our knowledge is just formatory knowledge. It's not true knowledge. We've recorded it mostly by rote or parrot-like, as Gurdjieff describes, and we become full of all this knowledge, of all these theories and ideas and concepts. But in a way, it's like none of it is real knowledge. It's formatory. In Beelzebub's Tales, Gurdjieff says the aim of the series is to destroy mercilessly all the rubbish accumulated through centuries in human mentation. And it's like if you attend university, that's what you do. You learn all this rubbish accumulated through centuries of human mentation, all these wrong ideas, wrong concepts. But people don't know this. Instead, everybody thinks that they, you know, you ask a person, how well do you know yourself? Like the Toronto Sun asked 5 people, and of those 5 people, 4 of them said they knew themselves pretty well, and the other two said very well. Everybody thought they knew themselves pretty well and very well. And they thought that knowing themselves meant like knowing their identity, their name, and what things they liked, and their preferences, and what their hobbies were. They think knowing themselves is like knowing your personality and your individual inclinations and so on. Whereas really for Gurdjieff, like to know yourself is this deeply mystical process of realizing this self, which is beyond the level of that personality and the mind. But you could ask individuals about anything, about, you know, what they think about God or afterlife, all these things. And people, we kind of think we're all in the know, and we're all kind of, in a way, we lie all the time when we speak. And it's like we lie because there's nothing real in us. And Uspensky says the most difficult thing to know is what you do know and what you do not know. And I think in beginning to study the fourth way teaching, I went through that experience as I was learning this teaching. At one point, Jim, I thought, my goodness, everything I've been taught in Western psychology and university education, it was all rubbish. And it was like, it was all formatory and none of it had any value. And then at a later point, that reversed for me. Because at a later point, when I had attained a certain knowledge and understanding, then I could go back and I could see the value in all these other things. But because I had a broader perspective, I could see the value of the, you know, other theories and concepts. But you can certainly see. Say again?
Sorry, I was just going to say, but you understood their limitations too, right? Because you have a broader, more comprehensive perspective. So you understand what is of value in them and what isn't, or how they're limited. And that's what's really interesting is that, you know, is that this perspective provides a much more comprehensive perspective to integrate things. And at the same time, it shows, it reveals how much of what we take to be our knowledge really is just like this conditioning and false idea of what we know and what we don't know.
Yeah. And you can see some of what I would say are major lies from the Uspensky-Gurdjieff perspective, like the modern theory of evolution, which is assumed to kind of work through mechanical processes, through random mutations and genetic changes. And in a way, that would be just so much lying. Or that we know ourselves, or that we understand God, and all these things that we think we know. And so the fourth way teaching encourages us to try to strip away this false knowledge. And it's like the more we strip away the false knowledge and just persist in not knowing, we don't have to reach closure in our mind and think we know these things. We want to cultivate this attitude of knowing what we really know and what we don't know. And one can see, hey, Jim, you start studying the psychology of lying, and then you hear people lecture and everything. And it's like everybody, like we're just such pathological liars, the way we can't speak about everything as though we understood it, and when really we don't. So,
yeah, and it's in the big issues, and it's in the little things. I remember that when I first became aware of this, that how often I would say things and I would just add on these like telltale phrases. I'm trying to think of one of the ones is that, you know, and stuff, that kind of stuff, you know, which really doesn't explain anything, but you think that it does. And then what you realize is that you're just kind of glossing over like that you really don't understand exactly what you're talking to. What the idea I'm getting at is that this introduces a level of precision into things, and so when people say something, you wonder, like, well, how do you know that? And how much of that do you actually know, and how much of that is you just parroting something that you've heard before, you know? And
yeah.
It occurs on all levels of activity, and you see how people lie all the time because they have this mistaken idea that, you know, if they have any sense of something, that somehow they understand it and that they know what it means. And you know, it's so prevalent that you just see how pathological it is. And then it gets into the lying on the level of governments and, you know, the big issues, like the people talking about, oh, that's just evolution, you know, in action, and they'll say, no, you're just kind of building something on something you don't really understand, and you're just tacking on. Like, that drives me crazy, these people who are always explaining things psychologically, and they say, well, you know, this is an adaptation in terms of evolution. I was like, no, it isn't. You know, the people say that all the time, that there's a whole school of thought like that. And I'm thinking, well, it's just these post-facto explanations of things that really don't, they're tautologies, you know. Well, why does that appear? Well, it appeared because it was evolutionary advantageous in an evolutionary sense. Well, it doesn't explain anything. It's just a, you know, after the fact explanation. It's, you're explaining something exists because it exists.
Yeah.
You know. So it's like you get these, or like when Stephen Hawking says at the beginning of his book, philosophy is dead, and then proceeds to, you know, write 200 pages of crummy philosophy. he's talking about things he doesn't know. It's a big, that book is a big lie, as far as
I would exactly agree. That's a perfect example of something that's just a lie. Like, he comes up with this idea about how these elements and these holes in these M theory and these little elements, how they could have 10 to the power of 400 possible states or permutations, kind of, and he kind of uses that to explain how the universe evolved as it did, and it's just really all just a confabulation, but it's not presented simply as a theory. It's presented as though this is the evidence of science, kind of.
Yeah.
But then, anyway,
Carl,
so this
Carl Sagan does the same thing in Cosmos when he says
exactly,
you know, that consciousness is produced in the cerebral cortex. And it's like, there's no evidence for that. Like, you know, you're just saying that. That's a complete lie.
Yeah, and then you compare that to someone like Penfield, the very famous Canadian neurosurgeon, who said back in 1956, it was clearly established that consciousness was not being created out of the cerebral cortex. So,
yeah.
Like, you know, and then in 1980, oh, Carl Sagan, you know, his tour of the cosmos, it's like, oh, he just throws it out. Oh, yeah, the consciousness is manufactured out of the cerebral cortex, and that's presented as, oh, science, you know, explain these mysteries. And it's really just complete quack science with no substantiation, you know. But, okay, so anyway, just to conclude this, I remember a quote by Uspensky. He says, I forget. He said, if we are like aware of what we really know and do not know, we are more conscious. So that's what we want to try to do, is become more conscious of what we really know and what we don't know. And most of what the influence of education is to get is to kind of put all this ephemeral knowledge into people's mind, and it's kind of tape recorded, and we take that over as our real knowledge. But as Gurdjieff explains, most of this knowledge, it's not transubstantiated in our being, meaning that we don't have direct personal experiences of what's being talked about. So we acquire all this knowledge, none of which kind of correspond to direct being experiences. So it's kind of artificial knowledge that's absorbed from outside, and then we repeat it parrot-like when different issues come up. I mean, we see this all the time, how the TV conditions us, kind of, and conditions people, and they... Yeah, they think they're in the know, and what it is just repeating things that you've heard on TV or other people have said, and so on and so forth. So anyway, that's the psychology of, we have to study this process of lying. And then we come to the eighth and last definition, and Gurdjieff emphasizes that the study of a human being and the study of the cosmos have to proceed together. That sometimes we can understand some processes more in ourself and extrapolate to the cosmos, and other times we understand things in the cosmos and try to extrapolate them to ourselves. but that the human being and the cosmos are both based on the same fundamental principles of mystical creation, which for Gurdjieff are the laws of 3 and 7. And Gurdjieff provides a very profound discussion of these principles, the laws of 3 and 7. And he expresses it in a way quite unlike how these same principles are discussed in other teachings. Like the law of 3 and 7 are definitely the basis of the Kabbalistic tree of life, which is 10 sephira, and you have 3 supernals and then 7 lower sephira. So the tree of life is based on the law of 3 and 7. We find the same principles in Tibetan Buddhism, in Christianity, esoteric Christianity. We find it in the Vedas, where in the beginning or before the beginning, you have Brahman, which is the kind of ultimate God source. And then you have what are called the 3 modes of nature, called Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, representing mind and intelligence, energy principle, and the material principle. So in mystical teachings, everything is said to have a triune nature. A human being, we're 3-brained beings functioning mentally, emotionally, and physically. In modern science, they think the universe is composed of matter and energy. Well, in the Gurdjieff perspective, you would say matter, energy, and intelligence, because the intelligence is inherent in the medium, but it's the unseen force. Gurdjieff describes human beings as being third force blind. So we always see things dualistically, and we fail to see the third element that brings the opposites into relationship. So Gurdjieff, in his system, he applies these laws of 3 and 7. And we should pick up on this note next week, Jim. I know we're just coming down. We got about 5 minutes here, so we should maybe wrap up a little bit. We've got through most of these definitions of psychology. I'd like to continue to work our way through psychological illusions a bit. Yeah. I think this is hopefully valuable and practical material. I think next week, you know, we can kind of move on and talk about the psychopathology of humanity from the Gurdjieff perspective, which I think is very useful. And yeah, we'll do our series on Beelzebub's tales. I think let's take at least one more week to work through some of this book, and then we'll go, move over and do 3 shows maybe on the tales.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think.
Have you had a chance to start rereading it?
No, but that's on my plan, because I just haven't had time, but I'm definitely going to start reading. I want to read it before the year's end, so, you know, even if I complete it over the holidays, but I do want to begin reading it. I just, you know, I think in general, just one quick comment is that I think the part of all of these definitions of psychology and the impact of the fourth way is that you're learning something new, but at the same time, you're trying to unlearn so much. Just like you said earlier about your education, you have to sort of empty yourself, and you have to get over the idea that you know and understand things, yourself included, and the world. And by emptying yourself, you sort of create this possibility to acquire real knowledge, and then it allows you to integrate what you do know and what you don't know, and so it's the beginning of a completely different path. So, you know, that we can pick up on that next time. But I think that's really critical. Like, it's like you have to empty yourself in order to be able to receive.
Yeah, yeah, it's like that story of the
Zen guy,
the professor who goes to the Zen master, and he pours tea into his cup, and he pours it over and over, it's flowing over, and he says, "Stop, it's full." And he says, "Yeah, just like your mind, it's so full of everything you think you know that there's no room for anything else." And in a way, you have to empty yourself first. And that's like breaking down lying, like realizing how little of anything we really know. And that opens up the possibility for something new. Okay, so I would like to encourage listeners, go to view my website at zeropoint.ca, And I'll be on the Don Nikoloff show, Evident Footprints, on Tuesday evening of next week. That's at 1 a.m. Eastern time, Tuesday night, which is actually Wednesday morning, but I count it as a Tuesday night show. So I'll be on Evident Footprints this week. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. I would encourage people, I have 4 books now available through Amazon, and they're really all very valuable books. And especially Psychological Illusions, which I think is the most practical of all the books I've produced. Wouldn't you say, Jim? It's such a practical system of psychology.
Yeah, very, very useful.
Okay, so thank you, BBS Radio. It's a pleasure, Doug and Don Newsom and Seth and the crew there. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll make the effort to remember ourselves. Thank you all. And thanks, Jim.
Yep, thank you, Chris. Bye.
Goodbye.